A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Welcome to A Tempo, the Classical Network spotlight on the arts and culture. I'm Rachel Katz, and I'm your host as we explore the changes at work in the performing arts. Each week, I'll bring you some of the latest news and also take time to examine many of the issues that are challenging these arts organizations. Today, we'll head over to the Muther Museum at Philadelphia's College of Physicians, which later this month is hosting a presentation by composer, pianist, and author Robert Greenberg about the music of Stravinsky, Debussy, and Schoenberg, and how their styles broke away and set a new course for the music of the 20th century. I'll speak with Greenberg and with Rick Fitzgerald, Chief Advancement Officer at the college, about the presentation and the college's other cultural collaborations. As always, let's start off today's program with a look at some of the news from around the world of the performing arts. The Philadelphia Orchestra will add two women to its conducting ranks next season, including one who will serve in a newly created role of conducting fellow. The orchestra announced the appointment of Irina Yashima as assistant conductor, succeeding Kensho Watanabe in a role that includes serving as a cover conductor for and assisting music director Yannick Nizet-Séguin and guest conductors, as well as participation in educational programs. Born in Germany, Yashima is in her third year as the Chicago Symphony Orchestra's George Schulte conducting apprentice. Lina Gonzalez-Granados was named as the orchestra's first conducting fellow, a position she will also hold with the Seattle Symphony. Born in Colombia, she previously has been assistant conductor of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra at the Ravinia Festival, as well as Carnegie Hall's National Youth Orchestra of the USA. The Philadelphia Orchestra also made news this week when Nizet-Séguin brought his personally crafted playlist to entertain the dogs and cats at a Pennsylvania SPCA shelter in Philadelphia. According to the Philadelphia Inquirer, the list includes Chopin Nocturnes, Schubert Songs, Mahler and Bruckner Symphonies, and, yes, Rossini's Cats Duet. In a statement, the orchestra said Nizet-Séguin, himself the owner of several cats who figure prominently in his social media, created the list with his partner to soothe the animals and provide a calm environment as they await adoption by their forever families. Communication channels were set to reopen between the Chicago Symphony Orchestra and its musicians as the players' strike, launched March 10th, stretched into its fourth straight week. According to the Chicago Tribune, attorneys for the two sides met last weekend, and both sides were set to meet the afternoon of Friday, April 5th, to discuss compromise proposals. The musicians and management have been at odds over salary and pension proposals. Art All Night, a 24-hour arts extravaganza in Trenton, New Jersey, will take place this June after a shooting last summer forced the popular cultural program to shut down early. In a statement on its website, Art All Night Trenton said it planned changes in access and security measures at the community event, which will take place June 15th and 16th. The organization said searches, controlled access to the Roebling Wireworks building, and a crackdown on alcohol and other items may lead to long waits, but were part of ensuring that the event can continue to serve the community by showcasing the work of its artists. The shooting last June left one suspected shooter dead and 22 people injured. Those are just some of the headlines this week from around the arts world. When composers like Stravinsky, Debussy, and Schoenberg in the early 20th century pivoted starkly from musical tradition and forged new directions for their music that was to come, much of it reflected the tumultuous changes taking place in the world around them. Reactions were decidedly mixed. Some embraced it, others recoiled in horror, not unlike the responses in today's audiences when they see a new piece listed on a concert program. That fear, or embrace, of change is one aspect that composer, pianist, and music historian Robert Greenberg will explore in his upcoming talk at the Muther Museum, located in Philadelphia's College of Physicians, on April 15th. His past lectures there have included discussions of the deaths of Mozart and Beethoven, and Rick Fitzgerald, the college's chief advancement officer, said such presentations are part of the college's efforts to show the connections between science and the arts. I spoke recently with Greenberg and Fitzgerald about the lecture and some of the other programs offered by the museum, whose collection of anatomical specimens and medical instruments includes Einstein's brain. I started off our conversation by asking Greenberg why the music of the composers he is profiling was so unsettling, and why, as he titled his lecture, we need no longer be afraid.
You know, this music that changed the language as we understand it, that was composed between about 1894 and the beginning of the First World War in 1914, this modernist movement, tends to be seen by audiences today as the beginning of the end of Western music as we know it, the point at which audiences and composers began to dwell in completely different environments. Music that is incomprehensible, atonal, ugly, no fun to listen to. So I can't change that opinion in a 90-minute lecture. But what I can do is give context to why the music happened as it did. And that's part of a long historical context. We're actually going to go back 1,000 years and observe how Western music has changed constantly as the environment around the composer changes. So we have to understand what happened at the beginning of the 20th century, and indeed throughout the 20th century musically, as a reflection of the larger cultural reality. And if there's anything we could say about the late 19th and 20th centuries is that they were marked by constant disruptive change. We began the 20th century in a world filled with empires, in a pre-technological age, or just the beginning of a technological age. We ended it in a computer age with none of the empires left. Everything had changed. And we as a species are having a little trouble keeping up with that rate of change, as evidenced by the events of the 20th century. But we can't expect our music to reflect anything but that. So the first and most important thing I have to do is make sure everyone understands that musical style, what happens, and this is true in popular music as well, is utterly a reflection of the larger culture. So we can't blame the musicians. Point number one. Point number two, going to take the great triumvirate of early 20th century composers, Claude Debussy, Igor Stravinsky, and Arnold Schoenberg, and explore how each one created his own revolution based on entirely different musical impetuses, if I can create a word there. We tend to hear music we don't know as sounding all the same, but these three composers' music are as different from each other as Bob Dylan is different from Janis Joplin, is different from the Beatles. Each composer had his own agenda, his own influences, his own inspiration. So the next thing I want people to do is understand where these three guys were coming from and to be able to distinguish between their music. If we can do that in 90 minutes, and having hopefully then created a certain degree of sympathy, because I'll also talk about these individuals as human beings, hoping that folks will go out and sit down at YouTube or maybe buy a recording or two and just take a kind of new degree of patience to this music and not react with that kind of knee-jerk, I hate this stuff. And if I can do that in 90 minutes, I will have succeeded.
It's not unusual that we see some intersection between music and world events. To what extent do you feel that, particularly in this time, the music directly represented or directly was impacted by these changes, or was it kind of just kind of parallel tracks where it was time for change in a lot of areas?
That's also true, but why is it time for change? What forces change on anything? We're much happier, generally speaking, with stasis. We can predict what's going on. We're more comfortable as a culture, as individuals. So what disruptive changes are occurring in the environment that inevitably do force change? In the case of Debussy, there's absolutely a cause and effect. There was a war between France and Germany in 1870 and 1871 that saw the end to the French Republic. It was an incredibly humiliating defeat at the hands of the Prussians, who were at the point of putting together their German state. The rejection of all things German by the French after this war was extraordinary. I mean, the French were still sending their students to Vienna and to Berlin to study before the war. Wagner was the overpowering influence in French music before the war. But after the Franco-Prussian War, there was a rejection of all things German, a creation of a French National Institute, and an attempt by not just musicians, but by painters and poets, to create a strictly French art not dependent on Teutonic examples, based on the French language. And if you listen to Debussy's music is the French language in action. Long vowels and diphthongs uninterrupted by sharp consonants. It's a cultivation of French at a very high level. That would not have happened had it not been for the Franco-Prussian War. Debussy himself despised the Germans, hated Beethoven, made a big fuss about his allergy to all things German. This is purely a result of current events, and its effect was extraordinary. I look at the Impressionist paintings. It's the same issue, blurred lines, smeared colors. It's not so much the object you're looking at as the feelings that it inspires. This is precisely what Debussy is doing in his music. So there's an example of a current event that had tremendous impact on a nation's way of expressing itself. For Igor Stravinsky, very much the same thing. The asymmetrical rhythms that so made his music different from anything that had come before were a direct outgrowth of the asymmetry of the Russian language, and he cultivated it. This is a guy who studied with Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov, the great Russian nationalist. He just took the Russian nationalist to the next step. Another thing you have to remember about Stravinsky, he's living and working in Paris in the first 10 years of the 20th century. He's surrounded by all sorts of post-Victorian movements, free sex movements, fauvism that was celebrating the presumed barbarity of Oceanic and African art. The Rite of Spring is a fauvist piece. Instead of African masks, it's using Bronze Age Russia as an example of a pre-moral, barbaric, and yet sexually free society. So the breakdown of morality that we see as a result of the technology and the philosophy of the early 20th century is absolutely reflected in the Rite of Spring. I could take the same track to Schoenberg. Point is, you know, the environment shapes the composer. The composer does not shape the environment. I could say that about any artist, in fact. We are what we eat, and what we eat is the reality of our times. If I was 20 years old and suddenly reading Einstein and Freud and Planck, you know, we take all this stuff for granted today, but until around 1895, educated people still believed in Newtonian physics, that there was order in the universe, that there was truth, that was God's own truth, and that underneath the complexity, the visual complexity of all things, was logic and rightness in the hand of God. And that article of faith was destroyed by the 1910. It didn't exist anymore. Everything was uncertainty. Everything was relative. The rug got pulled out from under the intellectual center of the Western world, and indeed, ultimately, the entire world in those years. And artists react in different ways to these kinds of things. But it was a fascinating time of tremendous change, and we see that reflected. Schoenberg's living in Vienna at the same time as Freud. His music is doing exactly what Freud was trying to do, and that was track the conscious and mostly unconscious activities of the human mind and go to the darkest places of the mind and try to illuminate them. If you look at the music Schoenberg wrote between 1908 and 1913, that's exactly what it's all about. The whole expressionist movement is about trying to find the inner structure of the mind and the motivations of which we are very rarely aware of. So it is fascinating, and it's all connected.
I wanted to turn to Rick and give you a chance to talk a bit about, first of all, the theater at the Mother Museum and what types of cultural programs you do bring in there.
It's not a theater per se, as we would think of a theater. As it's more, I guess it could be akin to a large black box, but it's not a raked theater. There aren't set chairs. It's a beautiful room. And we first began to realize the potential for this room when Richard Woodhams, the now retired principal oboist at the Philadelphia Orchestra, played one of our first concerts there, and afterwards he said, I've been looking for this room my entire life, that he thought the acoustics were so good in the room. And so we began to think about other ways to use the room. So the core of what we're doing remains the series we do with the Philadelphia Orchestra of Musicians. And the wonderful thing about that series is that we really let them set the program for each one of the events. What do they want a chance to play that doesn't get programmed normally, or maybe it does get programmed normally, but they're bringing in a soloist to play it, and they'd like to play it. So they really have a lot of fun with this. We have a lot of fun working with the musicians. And it kind of culminated last spring when the new early reputation of this series was such that Yannick actually stepped up and decided to play an evening with the orchestra of musicians. And that was just so exciting. I can't even begin to tell you how exciting it was. So we use the room, therefore, for a variety of different events throughout the year, from old-fashioned medical-based lectures to everything that can in one way or another fall under the heading of medical humanities. We really want this building to become a cultural center not just a museum, not just a place for concerts, but a place where people can come for a whole variety of events. The first is this Murder at the Mooter, which is a really fun event, kind of recreating a police procedural with a real detective, a real police investigator, real forensic scientists, and a real problem to solve. All the way to the other end of the spectrum, where we put on every year a birthday party at Dr. Thomas Mooter's birthday, which is March 6th. And we're recreating a 19th century club called Club 13 that started originally in New York City. It no longer exists, but we took the model. It's a club that laughs at superstition. So superstition is a great theme to link with a museum of medical specimens and a museum that concentrates a library and a museum that concentrates on medical history. So we look back at a historic New York City private club. We recreate that atmosphere, and we do it to celebrate Dr. Mooter's birthday. So we have a lot of fun with the space. And Bob's lecture, this will be the third one he's done for us, is an extension of this kind of programming in the space. It connects to the Philadelphia Orchestra musicians. Bob has a wonderful ability also to connect to different aspects of medical science and to different aspects of the museum.
The room that Rick is talking about is the single most beautiful room I have ever worked in. High ceiling, paneled, I mean gorgeous, and the sound is unbelievable. It's worth just going to experience the room, and you're not going to hear me say that very often. It is just the kind of room that you can't build today, acoustically, terms of expense, the woodwork. It's just spectacular.
We do see more and more connections, both from the angle of health, wellness, and music, and also museums and other arts institutions collaborating more and more with music. How did that particular presentation fit in, and are there other examples that you've done in the past or are exploring?
Well, I think these collaborations are the future for all of us. You know, if we just stand in our own little niches and try to constantly draw our own audiences without overlapping, the nonprofit world is dead. The lecture that I'd done in Dallas on the Rite of Spring, well, those lectures were held in the Nasher Sculpture Center, which is across the street from Symphony Hall, because the Nasher Sculpture Center, again, has a beautiful presentation room, this Nasher Sculpture Center, which is a new museum. It does collaborative work with the orchestra across the street, because this way they get orchestra patrons into the sculpture museum. They overlap their materials. And since music is art and sculpture is art, why not overlap them? These kind of collaborations have to take place. And I'm troubled sometimes by some of the performing arts organizations, the old-time organizations, specifically operas and symphonies, boards that tend to be perhaps, without any insult, because I'm not getting any younger, but perhaps on the elderly side, who still want to do things the way things were done in the 40s and 50s. Well, you can't do that anymore. The world is changing, and we have to bring the music and the art to the audience. We can't expect the audience to constantly and keep coming to us. And the more connections we can create across the board, the more relevant we can make the art. That's why I love talking about context, because context means relevance. The more real this stuff becomes, the less people are likely to be temporally turned off. Why should I listen to music written 150 years ago? Well, because it could have been written yesterday, and it was written by people just like you, and it will tell you more about your life than if you stood in front of the mirror for half an hour.
I couldn't agree more. It's what our museum has been doing, or our institution here has been doing, with, I think, real passion for the last 10 or 12 years. We realized that if all you had was a dusty old museum of curiosities and a restrictive membership, it wasn't going to succeed in the 21st century. And over the last 10 or 15 years, the College of Physicians has literally just opened its doors to the world. We have hair artists in here. We have individuals who've made art from x-rays, coloring in certain kinds of x-rays. We've brought in operas that have to do with dementia and cancer. I could go on and on. I mean, we have one of the most successful beer garden series in the city. But when we get 800 or 1,000 people in this building for a beer garden, our medical historical library will do a pop-up on some really intriguing medical anomaly or medical issue And the museum is open with guides to interact with people. So it's a way of having fun, but at the same time introducing people to all many of the issues that we're passionate about here. We have the most important history of vaccine website in the world. Literally, the World Health Organization has said this is the place to go for truth, the real truth about vaccines. So we want to engage the world. That website, by the way, gets between, I think it's around 3 million hits a year. So we're reaching out to the world in every way we can, through social media, through websites, through the programs in the building, because we want to connect people to what we're doing, and we want to know what they're doing. We want to also be a presenter, a place where not just our own collection, but the collections of others and the music and the thinking of others can be shared with our public. Our education programs are incredibly robust, over 200 school groups each year. Also, a series of specialty programs, the Karabatz Junior Fellows Program, the Teva Pharmaceuticals-supported summer internship programs, our Out for STEM programs, all reaching out to different groups, underrepresented high school students in Philadelphia, underrepresented people in the scientific and medical fields, and works with those groups to bring them into the science fields, into the medical fields. They've been highly, highly successful. And the other program I failed to mention was our public health program. Our public health grand rounds, which happen 3-4 times a year, co-sponsored by the Philadelphia Department of Public Health, typically attract around 300, 350 people to those evenings. So just more examples of how we see ourselves as a place of medicine, of science, and of medical and scientific humanities, engaging the public in every way we can.
What are some of the regular exhibits and central themes that are displayed at the museum?
Well, right now we have a photography exhibition up. The photography exhibition is about looking as carefully and as thoughtfully as a great photographer can at the collection in the museum. So it's a way of looking at the collection, the specimen collection in the museum, in a new way. A recent library pop-up exhibition had to do with STDs. What is the history of STDs? What do you know about, how about back in the day when syphilis was the most important, within quotes, STD in the world? What was that all about? How has that changed? We had something like 500 people come to that pop-up exhibition in an afternoon. A current small exhibition that we're doing in the museum is called Imperfecta. You know what? We believe our museum educates everyone to what it means to be human. Well, what it means to be human doesn't always mean a perfectly symmetrical body, as most of us are, honored to have. Sometimes the human body can come in other forms. And how has society, how has culture dealt with that? Obviously not well, over the years. And what do we think about that today?
That's a wonderful segue back, because you just raised the question, what does it mean to be human? In many ways, music tries to do that as well. Bob, You've done many types of programs to reach out to the broader public and introduce them to music, help them understand music. What do you find to be the most effective ways of reaching people who either A, when it comes to, quote, new things, recoil, or B, there's the prevailing opinion that, classical music is so old, it's not worth my time?
What really reaches people is introducing the music as a product of a human being who was alive and who had to write this stuff down and existed within an environment. Again, context, number one, historical context, but humanizing these composers. You know, we talk about Beethoven and Bach and Mozart and all these dead German-speaking people, and the occasional French and Russian and Italian speaker as well. Well, we have to take them off the pedestals we have created for them, and we have to talk about them as individuals who live lives just the way we live our lives, so that we can identify with them and with the choices they made. That's a key. You know, we're all voyeurs, especially in this age of the screen and of movies and of TV and the internet. We like looking at other people doing things. Well, we have to take that same voyeuristic attitude towards these neat dead German cats who wrote all this music. And that's a healthy thing. Some people when I get criticized, I'm criticized for demeaning this fine Western art and making it a common thing accessible to everyone. Well, excuse me, having grown up in South Jersey, that's who I am. I'm not an elitist. I want this music to be available to everybody. The composers certainly were not elitists. They were working class people who were doing what they did for a living. So you have to introduce the composers as people living in a real world and their music as an extension of their lives and their world. And here's the game I would play, and indulge me just for a second. My dear father passed away, God bless him, a couple of years ago. He was 92 years old. Three of my father's lifetimes, okay? Someone's born, they die, born, die, born, die. My dad's lifetime, 92 years. Three consecutive lifetimes, that's 276 years. 276 years ago, it was 1743. Johann Sebastian Bach was 58 years old, living in Leipzig and working on a piece called the Goldberg Variations for harpsichord. In 1753, George Washington and Joseph Haydn were both 11 years old, Washington presumably chopping down cherry trees. In 1743, Mozart will not be born for another 13 years. In 1743, Beethoven's mother, Anna Magdalena Kevrich, had not yet been born three consecutive lifetimes ago. This is basically the music of our concert repertoire now, the music from the early 1700s to today. There's no old music there. This is all music written recently by people just like us. And it reflects a world, okay, they didn't have smartphones and tablets in 1743, but they had all the same smarts we do. In some cases, more smarts, because they spent time reading instead of skimming. This music is utterly relevant to us today, and it reflects very much the same world and the same experiences we have today. So that's what I tell people. And, you know, if you do it well and you illustrate your points with lots of visual and musical representations, you tell people what to listen for, what this is supposed to mean metaphorically. I have never had a crowd I couldn't bring over to my way of thinking because it's wonderful stuff. I mean, it's not like I'm teaching statistics. It's like I'm teaching sex ed or wine. It's stuff everybody likes. You just have to find a way to illustrate it properly and to give everyone a good taste of it and then move on from there. That's how I do it, a kind of holistic approach. And you talk about the music as something unto itself, but you also talk about it as a product of its time and the unique personality and skill set of its creator. And then you talk about the creator, too. And you try to put it all together into a neat package. You tell the story. Because that's what music is, it's storytelling. And that's what teaching is, it's storytelling. And that's what performing is, it's storytelling.
That was my conversation with author, pianist, and composer Robert Greenberg and Rick Fitzgerald, Chief Advancement Officer of the College of Physicians in Philadelphia. Greenberg's presentation, We Need No Longer Be Afraid, will take place Monday, April 15th at the college's Mueller Museum at 6:30 p.m. You can find more information on this and other museum events at muellermuseum.org. I hope you enjoy these conversations that I bring you each week on A Tempo that focus on the changing dynamics and challenges in the arts world. But remember that programs like this are made possible only through your support of this station. To become a member of the Classical Network, go to wwfm.org and click on Donate. Thank you for your support of the Classical Network. Thank you for listening to A Tempo. I'm your host and producer, Rachel Katz. Join me again next week as we explore more issues and trends in the world of the performing arts. A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you.